Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are now ready for the third oral argument of the day. It's case number A20-361, State of Minnesota versus Rarity Shamir Abdul Lampkin. Counsel, both attorneys are familiar with our court procedures and the time allocations are the same on the Zoom format as if we were in the courtroom. Appellant's counsel will initially have 15 minutes. Respondent's counsel will have 15 minutes in response, and then appellant. Using the gallery view. So with that, counsel, and I would also say as well, I apologize. Excuse me if I may have frozen momentarily. I was going to apologize for being slightly behind schedule. The first case especially took us longer than expected, and that's why we are starting a little bit late, but of course that does not affect the time allocations. In this case, both attorneys will have just as much time to argue as if we'd been on time. Okay, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing Rarity Lampkin on this appeal. This case centers around the necessary mens rea an individual must possess to be guilty of assault harm. Under State versus Dorn, to be guilty of assault harm, an individual must intend physical contact that the law defines as unlawful force. Here, the circumstances support a reasonable inference that Mr. Lampkin intended to use force that the law defines as lawful, and specifically that he intended to use force in resisting a crime against his person of assault and false imprisonment, and also to resist interference with property. So based on that intent, that there's a reasonable inference supporting that he possessed that intent, that force he was using was lawful. It's our position that that the evidence was legally insufficient to support the conviction.
It's only in recent years when we've applied the a more rigorous circumstantial evidence review of intent. I mean, there's just such a significant body of law where the Supreme Court for many, many years has said, you know, intent's one of those things you infer. You don't have direct evidence of it. It's proved by circumstantial evidence, and we tend to rely on juries more for intent than other factual concerns about circumstantial evidence. It seems that, you know, to agree with your argument would essentially mean that any time a defendant says, I thought I was using appropriate self-defense, that and the defendant doesn't take the stand, and then you're stuck with the possibility that, you know, there is some possibility that maybe even a reasonable possibility that there's something else going on in his head. I don't know of any cases where we've reversed on this.
I'd say in response that it does have to be a reasonable inference, and you know, this court and the Supreme Court held that just speculation that a defendant had a certain intent that isn't sufficient to raise a reasonable inference that's inconsistent with guilt. So what makes this case different is there are circumstances in this case that aren't present in a typical domestic violence case that do support a reasonable inference that he thought he was using lawful force. In a typical case, and also in the Dorn case, the use of force was not preceded by any act by the complainant of violence or any crime against the person. This case is different because the facts that were proven at trial and really are undisputed include that the complainant was forcibly trying to keep him in the apartment building, that she did hit him in those efforts to keep him from leaving with the safe. And that all happened before the physical contact by Mr. Lampkin. So I don't think this case requires this court to adopt a rule that broad, where anytime a defendant thinks he was justified in using force, it raises a reasonable inference inconsistent with guilt.
There's evidence in the record that a child called the police to say that mother and father were fighting over a safe. I'm talking about the circumstances that occurred before the video captures the events. And I'm trying to get a sense of how it is there's not at least enough to support the conviction based upon the events occurring before your argument that arises from the video.
We can see that there is a reasonable inference consistent with guilt. It's just all our argument would be that there's also reasonable inference that he thought he was using lawful force when he had the physical contact. The call from the children did describe fighting. It didn't describe physical violence. It used the more general term fighting. The complainant's testimony at trial was that she was the physical aggressor.
Yes, at trial, but juries frequently recognize that victims of domestic abuse will modify their testimony at trial to be more sympathetic to the state's case, and maybe even or sympathetic to the defendant, and even hostile to the state's case. So, the jury did receive not just the statements from trial, right, from the complainant, but also learned about her statements that were made to police at the scene.
That's true. And the jury did hear that as well. But even with that, the state's position on appeal and also at trial was that the physical assault that occurred in this case by Mr. Lampkin was that act of that occurred by the doorway where he lifted her and she fell to the ground. There was no argument by the state that he engaged in assault harm before that physical act. While her initial statements didn't detail everything that she did in the same way that she did at trial, trial added a lot.
So just so we're clear, is it your position that the incident that happened in the apartment, not at the doorway, is the only assault that the jury could base its conviction on?
I think anything that the jury concluded, that the evidence supported it, that could support the jury verdict. I take that whatever, the jury doesn't necessarily have to follow the state's factual theory as long as the evidence that's presented to them supports the evidence.
Just so we're clear, the evidence, do you acknowledge that the evidence of harm could have been based upon the guilty verdict as to harm could be based upon what happened in the apartment, not necessarily just the doorway? Do you acknowledge that? Or are you saying that it's only the doorway that could support the conviction, if either?
I believe that what was offered at trial, only the doorway incident meets all the elements of assault harm. There wasn't any evidence offered that the complainant suffered physical harm by anything that happened before what happened in the doorway.
Well, there's testimony that she was pushed down and that she was, expressing some pain, but I'm just curious whether there is any distinction made at trial that the pain that she was suffering couldn't have been the result of both the incident in the apartment and at the doorway.
That argument wasn't made at trial by the state. They didn't offer, what they argued at trial was that the causation between the physical contact and the harm occurred with the incident by the doorway. And so there was no argument made that she suffered physical harm by anything that happened other times during that incident. That was the factual theory that the jury was presented with. Even if the court were to look more broadly at the entire incident, I think the same reasonable inference for Mr. Lankin would be present, because throughout the incident, she was, the undisputed facts at trial were that she was, you know, hitting him, and she was forcibly trying to prevent him from leaving. So the same theory that he could use force, you know, to resist those crimes against his person, I think even if the court were to look more broadly at the incident, there would still be a reasonable inference that he believed that any force was, that he intended any force to be lawfully applied.
If I could take you to a different track, the other issue you raised regarding the jury instruction, I'm curious your position on this as to whether the Supreme Court statement in Devens, in the cases that occurred before it, equating the statutory, quote, offense against the person, close quote, with bodily harm, means that the reasonable fear of physical bodily harm is always necessary in every case of self-defense. What's your position on that?
We would agree with that, but the.
So you would agree that an offense against a person that doesn't involve bodily harm can't justify self-defense under the statute?
It would. I mean, I think under under the complete definition of self-defense, you know, where a defendant has to have a reasonable belief of an imminent threat of bodily harm, and also under the way this court defined a crime against a person in State versus Southcup as well, that the offense has to be a physical nature with the potential to cause bodily harm.
Well, Southcup involved a fight. And so bodily harm is conceivable in a fight. But I thought you were arguing that the offense of unlawful arrest or false imprisonment could justify self-defense. You're conceding now that it doesn't, unless there's
no. Our argument would be that it depends on the manner in which the false imprisonment occurs. I mean, to make out self-defense, the defendant still has to have a subjective fear of imminent bodily harm, and that subjective belief has to be reasonable. So here, the false imprisonment was committed in a way that it did present a risk of bodily harm, because she was, you know, using false imprisonment, or she was forcibly trying to keep him in the apartment. The false imprisonment was accompanied with physical contact by pulling him and hitting him. So there could be cases where the false imprisonment wouldn't be sufficient, but I think in this case it is.
So a person, just so I understand your argument, which is surprising to me, that a person who is being imprisoned falsely cannot use force to escape unless there's some physical harm, bodily harm, associated with the false imprisonment? That's your position or your concession?
I mean, our position would be that the elements of a self-defense claim, you know, do require the defendant's fear of an imminent bodily harm as well. So, you know, there is law supporting that a defendant has a right to resist a false imprisonment, but the specific question of whether self-defense, as it's defined by Minnesota law, it does have elements of a fear of bodily harm. So that would be the reason why looking at whether a particular false imprisonment supports a self-defense claim, it does require a consideration of whether the defendant feared bodily harm. I mean, that would be our position. But I mean, I guess the most important point with our appeal, though, is that was met in this case, or the jury could have found that to be met in this case because of the way in which the false imprisonment occurred, that it did present a risk of physical harm to Mr. Lampkin.
But your point is that the district court's decision to use the word assault instead of offense is itself the instructional error.
Right, because it limited the jury to consideration of whether Ms. Washington, whether Mr. Lampkin was resisting an assault by the complainant, where it should have also, the jury should have had the opportunity to also consider whether he was resisting a false imprisonment committed by the complainant at the time of the offense.
Does the reasonableness of force used vary or depend upon the fact that the other person is a person who's 8 months pregnant?
I think that is, it doesn't change that force could be used. I mean, it may be a relevant consideration in whether that force was indeed reasonable. Our position is just that Mr. Lampkin didn't intend for his force to be unlawful. So, her pregnancy may be a relevant consideration that the jury made deciding whether it was in fact a battery that occurred, which is necessary for assault harm. But that still doesn't establish that Mr. Lampkin acted with the necessary intent.
One more question regarding this self-defense. Did the jury instruction include reference to no opportunity for retreat? And does the evidence show whether there were any other exits from the building that he could have used?
I believe that I'll confirm this before rebuttal. I do believe the jury instruction did reference retreat. And there's no evidence, though, of other exits that he could have used. And I know the state focuses on the fact that he left and returned. We would just emphasize that even after he returned, the complainant was again forcibly trying to block the exit. So even in that situation, he still was unable to get out of the exit.
Of that door, at least.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. If there's nothing else, I'll reserve or I'll go to rebuttal.
Yep. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your clients and begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. McLaughlin, my name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I am here on behalf of the state of Minnesota, who is the respondent in this appeal. In this case, Your Honors, the appellant is asking this court to reverse a conviction, a verdict of guilt on felony domestic assault that the jury found based on intentional infliction of bodily harm. And this is based on their claim that the evidence was insufficient and that there was plain error in the jury instructions. In this case, the evidence was clearly sufficient to support the verdict, and there was no plain error in the jury instruction. And before I go into why that is the case, just after listening to appellant's oral argument, I think it's important to just plant one idea, and that is that this court's review on both on sufficiency and on the instruction has to be based on the case that was tried, the facts and the evidence that was presented, and the defenses that were presented to the jury in this case, not on how the case could have been tried or what defenses could have been submitted to the jury. And I can go into that a little bit more when I talk about why the evidence was sufficient. So starting with the issue of sufficiency, this conviction of felony domestic assault is based on the intentional infliction of harm, a general intent crime, where it's very clear from the Dorn case is the best example, that because it's general intent, the appellant only needed to intend to commit the act that resulted in the harm. He did not need to intend the result or intend any specific harm, only intend the action. In other words, the act of throwing her to the ground. Now, at trial, the appellant essentially tried to defend on two fronts in this case. First of all, by saying it wasn't an assault, and this came in through the victim's testimony that she tripped, despite her testimony to the police and to the doctors that he had thrown her to the ground. And then his second line of defense, so to speak, was even if this was an assault, it was self-defense. Self-defense. That is the only defense that was asserted. On September 17th of 2019, he filed his notice of defenses. Self-defense was the only defense asserted, not defense of property. Self-defense.
Wasn't he arguing that he was trying to leave the building? Wasn't that part of the defense?
I believe there was some argument about that at the trial in the closing argument. Correct. So, but I...
Okay, I want to take you to the self-defense statute. You say it's not plain error for the court to have used the term assault instead of offense. So when I look at the video and I consider the testimony of the appellant trying to, or the argument of appellant that he was trying to leave the building, it seems consistent with the video that the complainant in this case was trying to prevent him from leaving. She was holding, at the moment that he had his arms around her and pulled her away from the door and she went down to the floor, she was holding on to the release bar of the door, pulling it so that the door couldn't unlatch. I assume you saw that also in the video.
Yes. And so I think
if it didn't appear at that moment as if there was any suggestion that she was engaging in assaultive behavior toward him, but that she was trying to prevent his egress. And I just want to understand the state's position as to what does the statute mean by offense against a person?
So offense against a person, as defined by the jury instruction in the case law that we've talked about today, is an offense of a physical nature with the potential to cause bodily harm.
Now, that's not what the statute says. That's what courts have interpreted it to mean. And as far as I can tell, dating back to 1967, when it was first interpreted, it is when the court has used that language, it has always involved the type of offense against a person that is, well, about which physical harm was integral to the offense, like a murder or threatened with a pitchfork back in 1967.
Correct.
But is it your position that an offense against a person does not involve any offense unless bodily harm is associated with the offense?
Well, I mean, as the instruction that was provided says in the case law, it says the potential to cause.
Hold on, I understand that. I'm saying that is it possible that case law developed under circumstances that always involved in those cases defenses against crimes about which physical harm was integral, like an assault or a threat, a physical threat with a pitchfork or a gun or a knife.
Correct.
So
I would agree.
If that's the case, then so there are other offenses against persons, either going back to the common law or even back in 1963 when Minnesota adopted the criminal code and included the category of crimes against persons. One of those crimes against persons was simple robbery, for example, a purse snatching, which may not involve any harm to the person. Assaultive behavior, like, let's say, offensive assaultive behavior, but not assaultive behavior that would involve any harm. Let's talk about like unwanted sexual groping, for example. Or false imprisonment. These are things that don't always involve any physical harm whatsoever. Is it your view that a person cannot use force to prevent an offense like that, like false imprisonment or improper touching or purse snatching, if there's no concern by the defendant that physical harm is imminent? Is that your position or understanding of the law?
I think that is the way the law has evolved.
There are no cases that support that. I mean, there's, like I've said, when you say the law has evolved, the language is used in the Supreme Court and our court's interpretation of this statute only in cases where there is likelihood of harm. Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say you're on the bus, or not you personally, but there's a group of people on the bus, and a couple of protesters get on the bus and they say, you know, we don't mean any harm to anyone, and we would never harm anyone, but we're protesting some statute. And so in order to make our point clear, nobody is going to leave this bus for the next hour until the news shows up and we make our point to the newscast. So we've got a small person at the back door and a big person at the front door, and the small person doesn't pose any threat of harm. Now that's false imprisonment. I think you would agree that would be a false imprisonment. Is it your position that a person in the back of the bus couldn't physically grab the person who's holding the door shut, yank him out of the way in order to get off the bus? That self-defense wouldn't protect that individual?
Based on the law, I think it's correct. Self-defense would not protect
that
individual.
Based upon what law? Is that not an offense against the person? False imprisonment?
It is, but it's not an offense against the person that has the potential to cause bodily harm.
Okay, let's take it a different way. Let's assume that there are several people on the bus and they're observing a small, obnoxious, creepy person attempting to grope children. You're allowed to use self-defense in defense of others let's assume there's no threat, that the person who's engaging in force to stop the groping is not concerned at all about bodily harm, but just simply wants to stop the offense against the person of an assault that doesn't involve bodily harm. Your view is that can't use force in that circumstance because there's no imminent threat of bodily harm.
Well, in that case, I would argue that the groping or sexual assault is bodily harm. And so what we have created...
Not as bodily harm is defined in law, not under the case law of self-defense, right?
Arguably, and we've carved out separate affirmative defenses. We have self-defense, we have defense of others, and then you have defense of property. And defense of property, you know, just getting back to that, is really...
I'm not talking about defense of property. Don't escape just yet.
Okay.
I'm talking about offenses against the person. I would grant you that most offenses against the person, if you go back to English common law, are offenses that can cause bodily harm. But there are a few, like false imprisonment, like strong-armed robbery by snatching, not by force, but by snatching, that kind of force, that don't necessarily involve bodily harm. And I've not seen anywhere in the case law that would suggest that you have to have an harm to a person, despite the language the court has used, given the fact that every one of those cases involves the usual case of offense against the person, that kind of offense that likely would cause some harm, but not so here.
Correct. I mean, I think I see the facts here differently. I think clearly what the victim was trying to prevent here was him taking the safe.
She was trying to stop him from leaving. She wanted him to stay. That seemed clear in the video and from her testimony. She wanted him to stop taking the safe because she thought if he leaves with the safe, he's never coming back. Somehow she saw something laudable in this fellow, despite his previous history of domestic assault. And, you know, who's to say, her choice of mates is her choice of mates. She doesn't want this guy to leave for whatever reason. He wants to leave. Your view is that as long as her attempts to stop him from leaving isn't going to cause him any harm, he's got to stay there.
Well, I think he has other remedies. I mean, he can call the police. He can do other things to leave. And the problem is this offense wasn't defined or fleshed out for the jury. So going back then to the to switch to the jury instruction gears instead of sufficiency. So in order for a jury to find an offense against a person, that offense has to be submitted to the jury, defined for the jury, and the jury has to be given the elements. And in this case,
isn't that position, the problem? Isn't that the problem with the instruction, that it wasn't given to the jury?
There was no, so the only offense that was defined for the jury was assault. So that was, there was no plain.
I think that might be the problem. If there's a problem with the instruction, it's that that was the offense that was defined and there was no assaultive behavior going on. So if I'm a juror, I might look at this and say, well, I don't see an assault, so I don't need to consider whether the force was reasonable.
But in order for a juror to consider other offenses against the person, which, as you've indicated, Statute 609 is full of other offenses against the person. If the appellant wanted the jury to consider other offenses against him, that was his time to do that at trial and ask that those offenses be submitted, and then they have to be defined, and the jury has to be provided with the elements of those offenses. And that is what I meant at the very outset when I said, you have to consider both sufficiency and plain error based on the case that was tried, not on the case that could have been tried.
I thought you acknowledged that at closing argument, the defendant argued that he was trying to leave.
I think there was a reference to him trying to leave, trying to take the safe and trying to leave. But the jury has to be, the law has to be explained to the jury. The jury has to be told what is false imprisonment and what are the elements of it in order for them to determine that that was committed. And there was no request. The defense agreed with the instructions as given, and they only defined assault. He did not ask.
I guess that's my question. So why isn't that plain error?
Because I don't think trial strategy is on the district court. I don't think it's the judge's job to think through the facts and say, what are all the offenses under 609 that I want the jury to consider? I think that is defense counsel's job at trial based on the facts. They look at the facts and say, what offenses against my client do these facts support? Because I want to make sure if I'm asserting self-defense, that I explain those offenses to the jury so they consider them. There was no other offense given to the jury to consider. So even if the court had used that generic language and just said offenses against the person, how, without any additional offenses being submitted to them, would a jury know all the elements of every offense against a person in 609 to consider them?
Well, would you need to cite them all? Why isn't the district court obliged at least to recognize that the defense argued that he was attempting to leave, she was attempting to stop him, and that he was only using force to get her to stop him from leaving? Why isn't that put the district court on notice that the offense against the person is the restriction on his liberty to leave?
I think the analogy I would use is consider when the state charges threats of violence. We have to identify the offense, the specific offense that's being threatened. We don't expect the jury to know every single crime that is a crime of violence. It has to be identified, defined, and they're instructed on the elements. Same thing with self-defense and offense against a person. If you want the jury to consider the potential offenses against the person, they have to be identified for the jury to consider. And in this case, that's the appellant's attorney's responsibility. It's trial strategy. What offenses against my client did the facts of this case support? Now, I would submit to you the facts of this case did not support false imprisonment based on the fact that he left the building, came back, the size difference between the two of them, the fact that he was easily able to throw her to the ground. But that was his attorney's decision to only have assault, which was already defined, to be the offense in front of the jury to consider. No other offense against a person was submitted to the jury. So without that, there just simply is no plain error. And sorry, I didn't get back to sufficiency, but it looks like I'm out of time.
Your time has expired, Ms. Pippenhagen, but we thank you for your argument. Mr. McLaughlin, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. And just to, I guess, begin sort of where where this discussion left off. Our position would be the judge's error here was to tell the jury that the only offense that it had to be an assault to make it exclusive. This jury exclusively look at assault rather than the full range of crimes against a person. So, I mean, if the judge had said that, the defendant, you need to find that Mr. Lampkin was resisting an offense against his person, that wouldn't have been error. We're not saying the judge had to specifically say that you need to consider false imprisonment. But how the judge erred was he said you can only look at assault. And that was the only offense that the jury was allowed to consider under that instruction. And we'll also point out that it is the state's burden
is it harmless error in the sense that, as Ms. Pippenhagen is pointing out, that there was no other offense identified for the jury? So how would a lay jury know I know offense against the person is in the statute, but if all you say is offense against the person, how would a lay jury know that what we're talking about are common law acts of criminal misconduct and what specific laws or crimes that might be involved? If it wasn't offered during closing argument or at any other time.
I think it's ultimately the judge's responsibility to instruct the jury as appropriate on the facts. So, I don't think the defense somehow waives the ability for the jury to consider false imprisonment.
What specifically should the judge have included on the facts? Just offense against the person and leave the jury to wonder what in the world that means?
I think it would have been appropriate to define what is an offense against a person as the case law has defined that term. And as the statute defines that term, and then to tell the jury applying that definition, you must determine whether Mr. Lampkin was resisting a crime against the person when, and then explain the facts that occurred in this case, when he attempted to leave the apartment and the complainant forcibly tried to keep him in the apartment. I think also it's relevant that it's the state's burden to prove or to disprove self-defense once it's raised by the defense. I think the question on sufficiency and the question before the jury is whether the state has disproved that the defendant was resisting a crime against his person. So because the state bears that burden, I don't think it's appropriate to put it on the defense to specifically cite false.
So are you suggesting that since it was the state's burden to disprove self-defense, that it was the state's burden to inform the court as to the possible offenses that could be listed under the offense against the person?
I think it was the state's burden to disprove any offense against the person that could be supported by the facts. And to the extent that they didn't offer evidence to disprove that he was resisting a crime against his person, I think that's on the state. That's not on the defense for not raising that issue specifically, since the state had the burden to disprove that he was resisting a crime against.
I'm talking about the instruction. Your argument isn't as to the sufficiency of the evidence to disprove self-defense. Your argument, as I understand your brief, is that the instruction was invalid, not that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support a no self-defense finding. Am I correct?
That's correct. That's completely correct. And the instruction was erroneous because, again, it narrowed the scope of the crimes that the jury could consider from assault to offenses against the person. And, our ultimate position is it's not in the defense, it's on the court to, when necessary, to clarify the meaning of terms in an instruction. And if on the facts of this case, more explanation was needed to explain what an offense against the person was and how that applied to these facts, that was on the court to do so. But the court did commit plain error by saying you can only look at assault when there were other facts in the case that supported other crimes against the person. And just very briefly, I know about sort of the statute and crimes against the person. The statute doesn't just simply says that self-defense is available for any crime committed against the person. Devin's and other cases have applied additional elements to self-defense from the facts of those particular cases. But we'd agree with you, Judge Ross, that the statute doesn't put anything on it beyond a crime against the person.
So you're retreating from your earlier concession, I take it.
I'm clarifying. Yes, I want to clarify my point.
Clarifying.
All right, I'm retreating. I was incorrect. The statute doesn't put any limit on it. The cases in the particular circumstances of the cases have talked about bodily harm, but looking at the statute, it merely says crime against the person. If there aren't any other questions, we'd ask the court to find the evidence insufficient, and alternatively, if it finds the evidence to be sufficient, to reverse for a new trial so the jury can consider self-defense under proper jury instruction.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The